like to talk and read all things books and mystery. Funny stories. The characters of youth always tend to be a sleuth. The hardy boys will do. Don't forget Nancy Drew. It's a clue.
Hello, sleuths. I'm Kelly.
And I'm Karen. Welcome to It's a Clue, a faux crime comedy podcast for teenage boys with motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
Today we are doing a Super Sleuth episode. We're finally here, Kelly.
It's happening.
We are going to be discussing The Hardy Boys number one, which is called The Tower Treasure. So many of our Patreons wanted us to do this book. I'm very excited.
Our number, including our number one patron, our father.
Yes. I also realized our intro song mentions the Hardy Boys. And here we are, let's see, 57 episodes in. And I'm like, it's time. It's
finally
time.
Getting around to it.
Yeah. Yeah. So without any other introduction, Kelly, I have a thought for you to ponder.
Ooh, I'm ready.
Who do you think?
I love to ponder thoughts.
Good, because that's not going away. Who do you think would win in a stand-up comedy contest?
Oh.
The Clue Crew, a.k.a. Nancy, Bess, and George, or the Hardy Boys? Please defend your answer.
Oh, that's hard. In a stand-up comedy contest. Okay.
Yes.
All right. I think the Hardy Boys would win. Because they are living in an environment where, like, making jokes is more encouraged. I think that's not to say that I think they're funnier than the Clue Crew. I just think the Clue Crew is they have like the curated, like, what do you call them? Like interpersonal jokes, inside jokes.
Yes. Yeah.
So like their comedy is like ribbing on each other and like situational between themselves, whereas the Hardy Boys I think are probably going to be better getting up and, you know, doing like, hey, so did you hear what happened at, you know, down at Joe's Crab Shack? I mean, not sponsored, but like two guys walk into a bar, you know, like I think there are more of those guys.
Interesting.
Which works better for stand-up. You go now.
I don't have an answer, and I think the crux of this question lies in what flavor of cringe do you prefer?
That is a fair point. Yes.
Because I think that the Clue Crew would over prepare for this.
They would. They would take it much too seriously.
I think they would have a skit sort of thing down. Oh, and gosh. I think they would just be really prepared for it. And it would have been practiced and rehearsed. And that can sometimes be uncomfortable to watch. I think the Hardy Boys would go in with no preparation.
Correct.
And do a lot of, you know, sourcing feedback from the crowd and riffing off of things in the moment, and that can also be uncomfortable to watch.
Trying to get by on their charm.
I guess what I'm saying is that improv makes me uncomfortable.
Girl, same. Like, when done well, impeccable. Yes. When not done well, really uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. Truly. Yeah, I remember one of the most uncomfortable moments I've had with the Clue Crew is when they were doing the comedic synchronized swimming.
That was exactly where they went into like a clowning situation, and that was heavily on my mind as well when I wrote this question for you.
Yeah, 75 years later, I'm like, ugh. Yeah.
I don't know.
There's so much distance and I'm still not into it. Yeah.
I love someone that can lead into the improv. It is not me.
It's just not me. No, I agree.
All right. Well, we will soon go really in depth into the strengths and weaknesses of the Clue Crew versus the Hardy Boys. But before we do that, it is time for daily announcements. And Kelly, I would like to hand the PA system to you.
Thank you so much. Firing it up. So first off, we would like to welcome not one, not two, but three new patrons.
Oh,
we have Allison my gosh. A. I know. I feel like a rock star.
I'm sorry. Say Allison A. again. I was so excited that I spoke over her name.
Allison A. We have Melissa, and we have Banfred. So
hey.
Welcome, to the Helen Corning Circle friends, and thanks for joining us.
Also, Banford, I'm not sure where you are from. I think you're someplace in Europe, because your currency is different on Patreon, and that just made us feel so good. We're like people from afar, farther than Michigan and Ohio and Kentucky are listening to us. We're so glad you found us.
We are. Everybody, we would love to know where you all are from, especially for those of you who, not especially for, but for those of you that we're connected with on Instagram and, you know, have a easy way to communicate with us, we would love to know where you live. So Yay. Let us know.
Thank you so much, Allison, Melissa, and Banford. We love you.
So next up is what we're calling, I suppose, notes from the bulletin board. So we got a message that we wanted to share with you all because it's both topical and interesting. So it says, "Hello, Kelly and Karen. I really enjoy the podcast. Listening to all your back episodes helped keep me entertained as I recovered from surgery for a broken wrist," which, bummer, hope you're doing better. We go on in the note. "Also, I was so flattered that my one-sentence plot submission to the Clue of the Dancing Puppet episode was selected as the winning entry. I'm contacting you because in that episode, you speculated on the plausibility of robotic puppets in that era, and these things actually did exist."
What?
I attended a family reunion in an old-fashioned resort in the Catskills. It was literally like Dirty Dancing come to life.
Oh my gosh, this is the best email ever.
I know. "This resort owns two of these puppets, and they're brought out as an entertainment finale on the last night of everyone's stay."
What?
I know. Can you hear how hard I'm smiling? "Both puppets are enormous dogs who play musical instruments and do a song and comedy routine with sound provided by a separate soundtrack and speakers. One of the puppets dates to the 1950s, and we were told is only one of two like him in the entire world."
Oh, okay.
I know. "If you want to see a picture and video, let me know, and I can post it in my Instagram stories and tag you. Thanks, Aileen."
Aileen, yes, please.
Yes, please tag us. I speak for all of us when I say yes, please tag us.
My mind is blown. I also ascended into another realm with, it was literally like Dirty Dancing come to life. Aileen.
Same. That whole like Catskills camp thing that's in Dirty Dancing, and also it's like Mrs. Maisel. Like,
yes.
You've watched that.
That's what I was picturing.
I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so into it. I think that's what I'm picturing or like wanting every time we talk about Nancy at camp. So.
Amazing.
Aileen, thank you for writing to us. And yes, please do tag us. We would love to see that and share it out with everybody so they can see these gigantic puppets too. It's crazy.
Brilliant.
I had no idea.
Kelly, thank you so much for that information.
Oh, you're welcome. I was just the messenger, literally.
Best messenger ever. I would love to know what you've been up to. What is your life like since last week?
Well, Karen, I would love to tell you. So I'm going to start off by saying that I know something you're getting for Christmas and you're going to freak out about it.
What is it?
I can't tell yet. Sorry. We'll let everybody know what it was after the holidays, but
I don't know how it could be any better than what I received last year, which is when you got me an American Girl doll that looks exactly like me.
It is okay. I'm gonna give you a hint. It's something you definitely want. I know that for a fact.
Okay,
but it's not something you can buy in a store.
Oh,
end of hints.
Did you make me something?
I'm not taking any more questions this time.
Kelly made me something for Christmas.
Didn't say that.
That's what I heard. That's what I heard.
But what other than torturing you with impending presents, I like nothing. It's just my favorite time of year. I've been working. I've been going out a lot. I'm like going to see shows. I'm like wearing all of my fancy black shoes, which I really enjoy, and earmuffs and things like that. I just love this time of year.
Oh my God, you do love an earmuff.
I do love an earmuff.
Are a big earmuff wearer, and they're so cute on you.
Thank you so much. I love an earmuff. I love a spiked hot chocolate. You know, I love a tinsel tree. So yeah, I'm just doing all of the winter Christmassy things. So what about you? What have you been up to?
Okay. I have two updates. one of them is not impressive, but I have my longest ever New York Times crossword puzzle streak.
And that I need completely impressive.
I need to boast about it somewhere. Listen, I know someone who has like a 43-day crossword puzzle streak. Oh. I got 6.
That's extremely impressive. Can I ask you a question and be honest? I'm not going to judge.
Absolutely.
Because I do it every day too. Do you cheat?
No, then that's what I consider a streak. I never Google. I never look anything up. And I only consider it a streak if I...
If it was like a true win.
From my brain into the crossword puzzle, into Will Shortz's mind.
Well, I gotta say then, that's incredibly impressive. I've never been able to do that.
You can, though. You can. It's just...
I can usually get through Thursday without having to Google anything.
Well, here's what happened to me, is that I got lucky in that a Sunday, I think I actually, it started on a Saturday, was very accessible, and I got Saturday, Sunday, etc. Then I got thwarted.
So you started off strong.
I started off strong. And you're like, oh my gosh, I got a Saturday. I got to keep going. Anyway, that was big for me. That was, I took a screenshot. I'm going to print it out, put it on my wall. Huge life moment.
Absolutely. I'm very impressed. That's the number to beat, ladies and gentlemen.
The other thing that I will say, RE, your update, which is like snuggly season. So the last time that mom came to visit, she brought me all the stuff from my closet, and I've been slowly unfurling it. And I've just been playing Barbies. All my littlest pet shops are in there. I've been organizing my troll dolls. I've got a whole shelf of trolls now. Like and every time I open one of these boxes, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's my Easter bunny troll. I don't know. Like,
what a like nice serotonin boost.
It is, like, there is a very happy little, like, childhood Karen corner happening in my office right now. Aww, and
that's amazing.
Brings me a lot of happiness. So,
I love that.
Yeah. That's all. That's what's going on over here.
Well, not to derail this conversation, but to then rerail it, do we want to pull into the recommendation station? Woo woo.
Oh, my God.
It was not on purpose. It just, words started coming out of my mouth.
Beautifully done. Yes. Recommendation station. But can you commit to the woo-woo a little bit more?
Oh, I'm sorry. Recommendation station. Woo-woo.
Thank you so much. That's <You're welcome. laughs> what I was looking for.
You ask for so little of me.
I do have a recommendation. I am 75% of the way through this book. It is the new S.A. Cosby book called All the Sinners Bleed.
Ooh, I've heard nothing but good things about this book. I have not read it, though.
Listen, girl, I love all of it. I have read all of his books. I love them. This is the newest one that came out this year. It is so good. I have not been able to put it down. I'm kind of switching back and forth between the print book and the audiobook, which will be no surprise to anyone. The audiobook narrator is absolutely fantastic because there are a lot of different voices in the book. Oh my gosh, this book is so good. It is very atmospheric, southern mystery, thriller, serial killery. Not for young readers, as we like to caveat. It is fantastic, and I am really hopeful that I will finish it this evening. So I'm going to blaze through it and bring it to you at Christmas when I come to see you. Yeah. You're going to love this book, Kelly. I can't guaranteed.
Wait.
Yeah.
I can't wait. It sounds right up my alley for sure.
Yeah. What are you reading?
So my recommendation is called Lovelight Farms by B.K. Borison. This is not like a super new book. It came out a couple of years ago. It's a rom-com. It's perfect for Christmas. It's about a woman who owns a Christmas tree farm, and it's not going so well, and her best friend agrees to help her out, and romance ensues. So it's really sweet. It's like a Hallmark Christmas movie in a book form. I will say, also not for young readers, like there is I would say probably a 4 level chili pepper rating.
4 out of 5 chili peppers?
Yeah. It might be a 3.5, but it's, yeah, I mean.
Okay.
Definitely we're not like, yeah, you understand what I'm saying. So, but it's lovely and it's the perfect thing for Christmas and the holidays and all of that. So.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Can I borrow that from you?
Yes, you may.
Thank you so much.
And it's the start of a series. So I think there's three of them in the series. I haven't looked ahead because I don't want to like know who the next couple is, if that makes sense. But
oh, it does. It does. Yeah.
But yes, I'm really enjoying it. It's very sweet. So
that sounds great. I'm jotting it down in my notebook right now because I would like to read that.
Very good. Love Light Farms. Like where the love light gleams. But Christmas Tree Farm.
Aww.
I know. So cute.
Cozy.
So with that being said, should we talk about the very first Hardy Boys book?
Yes, I think that's why everyone's here. Thank you for bearing with 10 minutes of us talking about other things in our lives.
16 minutes, Karen. It's been 16 minutes.
Well, one of those I was
whatever
coughing, and you're going to edit that out. That's so, true. You know, we'll
that's
see.
That's true. We'll whittle it down.
All right.
So were you able to find some history on this Hardy Boys book?
Yes, I was. Okay. So everyone, be so excited. This is the very first Hardy Boys book in the series. It is written originally in 1927, which is when Nancy Drew started, too. Similar. The ghostwriter for this book is named Leslie McFarlane. So, new ghostwriter alert.
Yeah.
And
very obvious, too.
Yes. Definitely someone we have not encountered before. And as with Nancy Drew, these books were written for the Stratemeyer Syndicate. It was revised in 1959 by familiar name, our girl, Harriet Stratemeyer Adams.
Aw, Harriet.
Yeah. Okay,
welcome
so
back.
Leslie McFarlane, the fella that wrote this book, he was a Canadian journalist, a novelist, and screenwriter. Like, this guy was writing all over the place. And my favorite thing that I found was in a biography that his son later wrote about him. Get a load of this quote. Get a load of this.
Oh, I'm so excited.
In his diaries, my father talks about having to write another one of those cursed books in order to earn another $100 to buy coal for the furnace.
Oh my gosh.
He never read them over afterward. It was only much later that he accepted any plaudits for the work.
Wow.
Yeah, so this, so Leslie McFarlane was like, this is not how I want to be spending my time.
Yeah, this is not what I got into this to write.
I'm an artist. He was doing it in order to earn another $100 to buy coal for the furnace.
Wow.
But these books are so beloved and have
absolutely
withstood the test of time. Like, here we are in 2023, almost 2024, talking about them almost 100 years later.
Isn't that so funny? Like, do you wonder what books are like being published right now that might in 50, 60, 70 years still be being talked about like this? I just don't know if there, it's hard to imagine that there will be.
Certainly nothing I've written is going to be around in 100 years.
Yeah, cheers.
Oh, also, I wanted to point out that The Tower Treasure, this book, became the basis of a series on the Mickey Mouse Club.
No, are you serious?
Yeah, it was apparently between 1956 and 1957, and there was like a series that you could watch about this mystery, and it was called The Mystery of the Applegate Treasure. And then for our, I know we have a lot of like mystery gamer fans that from the Nancy Drew computer games. There is a 2008 video game for this book that was released.
Very cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to have to find that Mickey Mouse Club thing. That sounds interesting.
I'd love to watch it. Yeah, it's from the 50s, so.
I wonder if it's like, do you remember that show that we used to watch called, was it 321 Contact?
Yes!
That had like the, what I now recognize as an adult was a spoof on Dragnet called MathNet. Do you remember that?
Yep. Also,
like, I wonder if it was that, like that, like little serialized episodes inside the Mickey Mouse Club episode.
That's my best guess. That's what I was picturing too. And like the Bloodhound Gang was on that show
too.
Yes. I had the same vision indeed.
I'm going to have to see if... I'm sure we can find some of that on YouTube. I'm going to have to go spelunking on the internet afterwards.
Okay, so next up on our list, Kelly, it is time for someone to win fame and glory on this podcast. It is time for the one-sentence plot competition.
There's nothing that gives me greater joy than bestowing this kind of fame on someone, unsuspecting entrant. For those of you who don't know, you can participate in One Sentence Plots over on our Instagram page. And basically what we do is we post the cover and we ask participants to guess what the plot is of the book based purely on the cover in one sentence, period. End of sentence.
You have to say my favorite thing that you say. Creative use of punctuation is often rewarded.
You said it perfectly. We do love a semicolon.
Yep.
So in this particular cover, the Hardy Boys are hiding behind this big tree, and as they peer around it, there's this like big stone mansion in the background with a tower, and there's this like very strong beam of light emanating out of the tower.
A tractor beam.
Very much so. So the winner, and this is not the first time that this entrant has won, handle is @honeyandhottea, said,
yay.
I know. Frank and Joe, thinking they are playing an advanced game of hide and seek, realize that they are actually trapped in a panopticon. I was like, that actually, I would read that book.
I would too. And congrats, Honey and Hot Tea, on a, you had a recent win as
yeah,
well.
I think it was the last one. It's been the last one or two episodes. Yeah. So
I also have an observation from this book cover coming hot off the heels of roller derby practice last night. The stance in which the two brothers are standing on this cover is an active roller derby moment. We have a brother in the back that is clearly in the jammer position. The one in front is like in a full crouch doing the blocker stance. And I'm like,
what's a jammer?
Oh, the jammer is the point scorer that's got to like lap the other skaters.
Oh.
So I looked at that cover and immediately thought roller derby, which is where my head's at.
Funny. I would also read that book.
Yeah, yeah. I was
Frank
actually
and Joe with the roller derby.
I was thinking about that recently. I'm like, we need a romance novel set in the roller derby universe. So maybe it exists, maybe it doesn't, but
listen, I'm pretty sure that there are more than one romance at a Christmas tree farm books and movies out there, so who's to say there can't be more than one roller derby romance.
I love that there's room for more. Well, someone else write it, or tell me that
I want you to write it.
Okay, let's both write it together.
I don't
want to
write it. I don't know anything about roller derby. I just asked you what a jammer was, and you were like, they're like the person. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think I'm the right person to write that book.
That's why we're a good team.
That's right. Well, without further ado, Karen, it is time for today's super fast plot. And this week, it is both written and read by you.
Okay, I'm going to do it, but I feel like this is a little meandering, so bear with me. I'm going to plow through.
You're going to be great.
Okay.
No apologies.
Me. While the Hardy Boys are running errands for their famous dad, private investigator Fenton Hardy, they're nearly blasted off their motorcycles by a crazy driver. They later find that that crazy car has been wrecked in a clearing and soon learn that their bestie, Chet's car, was stolen just after the crash. Also, nearby, someone has tried to hold up the ferry boat ticket office in Bayport. Related? The plot continues to thicken when Herd and Eileen Applegate, the reclusive owners of the Tower Mansion, report that there's been a theft at their mansion. Someone has robbed their safe. They are very adamantly accusing Mr. Robinson, their caretaker. He's an upstanding fellow, and his son, Slim, is also BFF with the Hardy Boys. There's very little evidence against him other than the fact that he may have seen the code to the safe and he came into some money around the time of the robbery, specifically $900. Mr. Robinson won't reveal where he got the $900 because he basically has sworn that he wouldn't tell. He won't break the secret even to exonerate himself. So off he goes to the slammer. His family is devastated and becomes immediately impoverished, and Slim has to drop out of high school to become a grocer. Sleuthing ensues. The Hardy Boys scout around the site of the car wreck and find a red wig, which explains why they kept seeing a red-haired man whiz by in stolen vehicles. Fenton goes to New York City, where this brand of wigs is made, then follows the trail of wig ownership to a Shakespearean actor who used to own the wig and was robbed. We learn that the criminal's name is Red Jackley, and as luck would have it, Fenton finds him and goes on a cross-country chase to nab him. The train car in which Jackley has hidden himself derails, and he nearly dies. There's an intense race between Fenton Hardy and the Bayport police to get a confession out of Jackley before he perishes. Fenton gets there first because some teenagers fake a bomb threat, more on this later, and Jackley confesses. Robinson's name is briefly cleared, and the police chief and his lackey, Detective Smuff, very annoyingly try to steal the Hardy's thunder. But after an extensive search by the Hardy Boys at the Applegate Towers yields no treasure, Mr. Robinson gets arrested again. Chief Colleg thinks Robinson is in league with the bad guy, Jackley, and is hiding the treasure. Frank and Joe are irate and terrified that Mr. Robinson will get sent to the slammer for good. Now they've really got a fire lit under their Hardy butts. Even Fenton Hardy feels helpless because they've searched everywhere and turned up nothing. Finding the loot is Robinson's only hope. Perry, aka Slim, Robinson's son, is grief-stricken, but there are no more clues. The brothers go driving around on their motorcycles with a picnic lunch and end up near the train station where Red Jackley used to work. Up on a hill, they can see two water tanks near the tracks, a new flashy one and an old one in disrepair that's been deserted. Wait a second, are these the towers that Red Jackley might have hidden the treasure in? Sure enough, they clamber into the old tower, almost fall to their untimely deaths, and find a hiding spot with a sack inside of it. Inside are the missing jewels and the stolen bonds from Mr. Applegate's safe. Fenton invites the Robinsons, Chief Colleg, and Detective Smuff to the Applegate's mansion to provide them some updates. Everyone is shocked when the Hardys reveal that the treasure has been found and Robinson clearly had nothing to do with it. The Applegates are finally gracious to the Hardys for their help. Smuff gets berated by Chief Colleg for not being smart enough to solve the case. Mr. Robinson gets his job back and a salary increase. Frank and Joe are called real detectives, which makes them extremely happy, and receive the $1,000 reward for solving the mystery. They have a massive party at the Applegate Mansion with all their besties, and Slim reveals that Robinson had received the $900 from someone who was in great debt to him. The Robinson name is cleared. The end. That was a lot.
That was a lot, and... well done.
Is that what the people need to know?
That is what the people need to know.
Okay. Well,
shenanigans, cars, money, towers, party.
That's the name of the episode.
Hardy Boys.
Hardy Boys. Okay, what are your general thoughts and musings? I'm dying to know what you thought about this.
I would love to tell you. I was not expecting to like this book, but I loved it.
Me too.
Loved it. You did too?
Yes, I loved it so much.
I wasn't expecting to not like it because it was a Hardy Boys book. I was expecting to not like it because it was the first Hardy Boys book.
Same.
Yeah. I just was expecting it to like not have its footing yet, kind of like the old clock situation didn't have its footing yet.
We had to go on a long journey until Nancy Drew crushed it. Yes.
But this crushed it right out the gate, and I'm a Hardy Boys fan now. I totally get it. I want to read more Hardy Boys. I loved it. Like, the mystery was fun. Like, there was constant activity. It was all a little, like, chaotic and full of mayhem and off the wall, and there were a lot of like random things that all came together to form one perfect little answer, comma, like the way they got from point to point to point was linear.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, yes. I feel like so often in Nancy Drew books, there's like three different things happening for 172 pages, and then on 175, all of them join together, and then the book concludes on 176.
Yep.
And this, it made sense that all of these things would come together.
Completely agreed.
Yeah. What did you think? General thoughts and musings. GTNMs, as the kids like to say.
I loved it, too. So I've mentioned this on the podcast before, but like you read a lot of Nancy Drew as a younger person. Mm-hmm. I was reading Hardy Boys because I was like, I have to be different. I don't want to just be copying off of my big sister. I remember none of this. This was like nothing was retained. So I was really excited to see if I still enjoyed them as I did. And I did. It was very genuinely funny.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a like eye rolly, oh my God, I can't believe this writing sort of way. It was I was laughing out loud a lot. Mm-hmm. Also, I read the book, the paper book and the audiobook, and the narrator for the audiobook is phenomenal, which I wasn't expecting.
It was great.
We don't have any audiobooks of the Nancy Drew books, which someone out there who wants to narrate these, I think the first several are in the public domain. Mm-hmm. Which is why the Hardy Boys have now been turned into audiobooks. So someone please do that. This guy, Jim Hodges, absolutely knocked it out of the park with a narration. He had voices for everyone, and I loved it. I know we're going to talk about this a little bit more later when we do a bit of a Venn diagram between Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, but these books, the Hardy Boys are supposed to be the same age as Nancy Drew.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt a lot younger to me than she does.
Yes.
I was just like, oh, this is what 17-year-olds would do and talk like. Which was a new and refreshing experience. So that was an initial observation, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think you say that. Like, do we know the Hardy Boys are 17?
Yeah, one of them is 17 and one of them is 18. I think they're a year apart. Okay.
So I think... Isn't Nancy 18 or 19?
Because Nancy's 18, yes.
18. So she's out, she's graduated from high school. And she's also like running around with all of these college people, right? You know, like Ned and everybody are in college. So I think they are maybe a little bit older, because I get more the vibe that like the Hardy Boy Club is more high school as opposed to more of a college crowd. But like, it definitely is a younger vibe, regardless of the like splitting hairs in 6 months of age. Like,
for sure.
Yeah. Definitely a younger vibe. So
we're like playing baseball and getting ribbed about like, oh, you're going to go sleuth. Well, we got a baseball game, guys. Like, why are you late? You know, I'm like, oh.
Well, and there's even a comment about, is Joe the younger one?
That's a fantastic question.
Yeah, good talk. One of them, it's like they're talking about a girl, like the narrator is talking about a girl, and they talk about how, I think it's Joe, she's the only girl that he can even kind of tolerate being around.
Yeah,
it's like they didn't say like Joe thinks girls are icky, but like it was still kind of like a Cooties vibe almost. So
yes, he has a crush on Chet's sister Iola.
Yes, yes,
and he's like, she's fine.
She's fine. She's tolerable. Yeah. if I've got to hang out with a girl, she's probably the only acceptable one. You know, I'm like, oh, romantic. Hie thee to a Christmas tree farm, Joe. So, Karen, can we move into my favorite section of the show, which is you telling me about your favorite parts of the book?
Yes, but you have to tell me about your favorite parts, too.
Okay, twist my arm. But you start.
Okay, I am going to pick a character from this book to speak about.
Ooh, okay.
He is a shady detective in Bayport named Oscar Smuff.
Not who I thought you were going to pick, but okay.
Who did you think I was going to pick?
I mean, a titular character, perhaps, or Fenton.
Oh, wait, a Hardy Boy, perhaps? No.
One of the Hardy Boys.
I did not see this coming. So the Hardy Boys have a pretty adversarial relationship with the local law enforcement.
Yes, I think that is a correct assessment.
Which is contrary to what we have encountered with Nancy Drew books. And correct. In cahoots with the local law enforcement is this, I think, self-ordained detective, Oscar Smuff.
Oh, you think he just like decided one day, like, I detect.
Absolutely. I am detective. Yes. Yeah. He's just like, I'll find some clues. So we catch him in a couple of questionable moments. One of the first things that happens in this book is that Chet's car, aka his jalopy named Queen, gets stolen. And Smuff is like, I'm going to find the car. he finds the first car that looks kind of like this at a used car lot, and he's like, here it is, guys. Now you owe me reward money. The Hardy Boys start scraping paint off of this car, and they're like, this is absolutely not the same car. Like, there's no way. And he's like, really, Oscar Smuff is miffed about this.
Yeah.
He also shows up at the Hardy household, where not only our characters, Frank and Joe, live, but their father, Fenton, famous.
World-renowned, famous detective.
Yeah. And Oscar Smuff is like, want to share some clues with me, Mr. Hardy? You know, then we can split the reward because I might have some valuable stuff for you. At which Mr. Hardy basically laughs at him, which I deeply enjoyed. But he is in the pocket of the local police chief named Chief Colleague, who is a real piece of work. Like, this guy, pardon my explicit language, listeners, but this guy sucks. Like, I do not like Chief Colleague.
My gosh, where is my bleep machine when I need it?
I know, clutch your pearls. This police chief is really pretty not on the up and up, I would say, and he's got this just like unpleasant Oscar Smuff assisting him. He's definitely the police chief's minion. At some point, the police chief calls him a coward to his face. They're basically cartoons. It's like the head bad guy and then the minion bad guy.
Absolutely. Cartoons is exactly the right way to describe it. And I know we're going to kind of talk about the like comparison between like Druniverse police versus Hardy Boys police, but what you're saying is exactly right. Like, it is a very different dynamic.
Yeah, and like, I think my favorite part is that approximately once per day in this book, Oscar Smuff says, I solved it, money please. Mm-hmm. And then the Hardys are like, oh no you didn't, and here's why. And he's like, oh rats.
Yeah. Back to the drawing board, stupid kids. Yeah.
A phrase that I like that they used to describe him to regarding this kind of lackey relationship is that they call him Chief Colleague's satellite. And I've never heard that word used before in that situation.
No,
and
I really love that context. Yeah, it was good. One of my favorite moments between these two characters was, and I know we're going to talk about this in a minute, but there is a bomb scare.
Yeah.
And the chief comes in with Smuff in tow and to check out this bomb potentially, and it's basically like a bag or a suitcase or something, or a box that has like a ticking coming from inside of it, you know. And Chief Colleague is like, Smuff, I need you to handle this for me. Go pour a bucket of water on top of that box. You might want to call your friends and relatives first and tell them you love them before you do it. But like that, and Smuff does it. Like,
he just, no questions asked.
No questions asked. He just does it. And there are so many great things about that, including one more interesting way to defuse a bomb. But yeah, there's definitely a power dynamic at play there for sure.
He also tries to assert his opinion at one point, and Chief Colleague doesn't like it. And he goes, who asked you, Smuff? And then Smuff goes,
nobody.
Kind of slinks away. And I was like, oh, Smuffy.
Oh, if Smuff is not a criminal in a future episode, I'll be shocked.
He should
just like totally turn toward the dark side after years of, you know, not getting the recognition he deserves.
I agree. That's my number one. What's your number one?
Oh gosh, I'm gonna have to go with just Fenton Hardy in general. Like, I loved Dad in
love
this
it
book.
Tell me everything.
So Fenton is like an actual detective. I mean, I guess like an actual private eye. He doesn't work for the police force, right? But he's like internationally known. People come to him from far and wide to solve cases. His dynamic with his sons is truly one, like, the most unexpected thing about this book for me. So
wait, Kelly, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I'm not even joking.
What?
Is that why they call it a private eye? Because it's a private investigator?
Yeah.
I thought it was private space EYE.
Well, I think it is. But I think it's like, I think it's a play on a play.
Private.
A punny thing, you know.
Oh my gosh.
Like you're an eyeball for hire, but you're also a private investigator.
Oh my gosh. I'm so sorry that I interrupted you. This happens once every three episodes and you say something and I'm like, is that what that word is meant to look?
No, I'm thinking back. I'm like, we learned what a B&E was together on this podcast. Mm-hmm. We learned why you call it a showboat.
A showboat. Private eye. Okay. I'm back in.
All right, perfect. But so like, I guess I'm just very, and again, I don't want to like get too much into our comparison with Nancy Drew, but like, I am so used to the dynamic between Carson and Nancy that this dynamic between Fenton and his sons was so different. I found it hilarious. So basically Fenton is like, laughs at them every time they talk about wanting to be detectives when they grow up mm-hmm. and be professional detectives. He just kind of laughs at them and is intentionally trying to kind of like keep them away from this investigation, which on the one hand I go, good call, Dad, like keeping your teenage sons out of a criminal investigation. Cool. I support it. But also like, when they do start to get involved and when he throws them these little bones to be like, okay, you want to go do something? Go over there and see if you can find the treasure that's hidden, you know? So that will happen throughout the book where they'll like run out and do a little piece of investigative work. And then they'll like run back like little puppy dogs and be like, what do we do now, Dad? Like, yes. or like, we found this clue. Is it a good one? You know, like, what do we do now? It's so funny. It's just not at all what I was expecting. Like, Fenton is not like a cozy father like Carson is.
No, no.
That being said, I also loved it because at one point, Joe and Frank kind of like not gang up against, but like they are in competition with Fenton, where Fenton on one team and then Joe and Frank on another are actively trying to solve this mystery to like independently win the prize money. Like they are not like a team. This
no.
is not a father-son team. This is Frank and Joe like, oh, we'll do it without you then. And
yes.
Yeah.
Nancy and Carson have a very, like, team is the perfect word, and this is more of a, like, player-coach situation, but it sometimes turns competitive.
Yes.
Which would never happen in the Drewniverse.
No. And it makes, Carson is not as much of a dynamic character as Fenton is. Like, Carson feels a little bit more like wallpaper a lot of times. Like, he gets brought in to, like, serve a purpose.
Yeah. Yep.
Fenton was definitely more of like a player in the activity in this book. Like if he weren't there, stuff would not have happened. But it makes me love Carson so much more because it does kind of like shine a light on.
I see what you did there and I liked it.
It wasn't on purpose. She shines light on like how much he like respects his daughter and trusts her, and like, he clearly has a high amount of regard for Nancy and her capabilities because he actively invites Nancy in and brings her in and passes clients off to her. And Fenton would not do that, or at least not in this book. So, also, I'm like, Fenton was giving me really strong Our Dad vibes. he has like a bunch of kind of like pithy one-liners throughout the book, and
yeah,
that
does.
I could just hear coming out of Our Dad's mouth,
like truisms. Yes,
yeah. One of my favorites is there's many a slip between the cup and the lip.
Oh yes, that is a thing that he says.
Yeah, which I've never heard before, but I'm like, I can hear. Our father saying that, so
I can too.
Anyway, I loved Fenton. I thought he was a very cool character. So very unexpected.
He definitely compelled me to read more of these books. I'm like, I can't wait to see how this relationship develops because it's intricate in a way that is interesting and complicated that we have not encountered in the Nancy Drew books.
Absolutely, there's shades of gray there, and I like it. So, what else you got?
Okay, so the Hardy Boys have a best friend. They have a couple. One of their best friends is Chet, who we talked about, whose car gets stolen. They have another friend that they love dearly named Slim Robinson.
Slim's, it's very Encyclopedia Brown, isn't it?
It is. And so Slim's dad, Mr. Robinson.
Mr. Slim Robinson.
He's the one that is being framed for the crime in this book. Yeah. And he's the one that we're battling so hard to exonerate and make sure that, you know, his family name can go on and they're not thrust into a life of poverty and shame for all eternity. Yeah. So
you know what? Pause, because you bring up a good point. This book, I think one of the reasons this felt like not higher, like maybe higher stakes, but more interesting or something. It's like the book is not about just solving the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
The book is about solving the mystery
and saving a family.
Correct. For like clearing an innocent person's name. You yes. know, it's not just about finding the jewels, you know?
Yes.
So.
And it's their friend. Like they know yeah. him, they love him. And this was so dramatic. So Slim is in high school with the Hardy Bros. And that's. Is that not what these books are called?
The Hardy Bros.
I forgot for a second. And he basically is so bereft that, you know, his dad's name has been besmirched. His dad is in jail. People all around, he's, you know, he'll just never work again. People all around town are like, he's a caretaker. He stole from the Applegates. Basically, almost overnight, this escalates from, oh no, something has gone awry, to Slim shows up at high school and is like, hey guys, bad news. This is my last day in high school. I'm going to drop out. I have to go work at the grocery store now. That's just mm-hmm. that's just how it do. And that seemed like it happened quickly. Also, it's very well known in the Hardy Broniverse that Slim has always wanted to go to college. He's like the smartest guy in the class. He's going to be the valedictorian. He is like Ivy Leaguer bust. And he just very quickly is like, this is it. This is my last day. I'm going to go work at the grocery store. And the dialogue around this is, I hate to say this because this is a very like upsetting situation that I think actually is probably very realistic in 1927 or whenever this was mm-hmm. written. But he's like, no, I'm really going to put my all into it.
In today, you know?
Absolutely. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm really going to put my all into it. And this isn't a direct quote, but he says, you know, and maybe if I even work hard enough in 50 years, I can be the manager.
Oh.
And I was like, Slim, my friend, we must solve this mystery. But Frank and Joe are just so like, okay, about it. They say, we're sure you'll be great at whatever you put your mind to, Slim. So
yeah,
sorry
if you
this
work
happened.
Hard enough, maybe you can be the manager.
Yep. I mean, yep. I think you can do it. I think you can make manager in 50 years. And I was just like, okay, guys, like
it's, and again, like it's such a different reaction to what the Clue crew would have, you know, mm-hmm. like they would hear that and go, we cannot allow this to happen.
No,
you know, Slim must go to college. And like they would have done, you know, not to like poach off of our, it would have been awesome if, but like they would have been like, we must do this to save Slim. And we're going to donate our $1,000 back to the Robinsons so that Slim can pay for his first, you know, probably 4.5 years of college with it. You know,
yes.
I mean, that would have been their entire focus. And it's just different.
Frank and Joe are like, buddy, that sucks, man. Mm,
sucks. Well, do you get a discount by any chance? Because I'll come in and shop during your shift if so.
Fenton
loves
a
melon.
I believe
you know?
In you, pal. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Well, last one for me is I really enjoyed this. So our bad guy is Red Jackley.
Red.
And
aptly named from his red wig.
Yeah, maybe a little on the nose, but I was like, oh, very clandestine, you know? I mean, that's like your name being blue and only wearing bright blue suits, you know? It's like way to blend in, Red. But the whole like race to get a confession from a dying man was like very high stakes, and like it led to a whole lot of interesting things that got to like happen around that race, right? Where We've got a criminal who is dying. He's the only one who can tell us what happened and, like, basically clear Slim Robinson Sr. So, like, it's incredibly important, you know? So, again, I hate to keep comparing to Nancy, but, you know, I don't think we've actually seen any of the criminals die before.
I was going to ask that question. I think this is our first perishing.
Like, in general, yes. Yeah. Like, period. Which is very interesting because usually when we catch a criminal, they confess immediately, you know, even to non-policemen, you know, they're like, Nancy, come on in here. You want to take his confession? You know, the guys are out getting coffee and they confess immediately. And that's the end of the book. So now, like, we capture Red Jackley like halfway through the book. And it's this whole series of events that rises up to get this confession because he ain't going to make it. So, some interesting things, though, happen, as I keep saying. So, basically, there's this race against the clock, not just to get the confession, but for Fenton to get there first and beat out, like, these bumbling police chief and his sidekick.
Yes, we got to beat Chief Colleague and Smuff.
Right. Partially because, like, Fenton wants the credit, you know, and he wants this reward. But more so, he thinks that if Chief Colleague beats him there, he's going to literally bungle this so bad that he probably, like, a confession will not be gotten.
Yeah, they'll just lose the chance.
Correct. So Fenton's kind of talking to his sons about, like, it's really important that those guys don't get on the train, and just, like, leaves that there with his try-hard kids that are trying so hard to impress him. And the boys are like, hey, Joe, do you want to try to keep the chief from getting on the train? And Joe's like, yeah, Frank, I think that's a good idea. Let's spitball some ideas. So they, like, get the baseball team together and they're like, we got to keep the chief from getting on this 7 o'clock train. So some ideas that are spitballed.
I can't.
Kidnapping and setting them adrift in a bay.
Oh my God.
Yeah. That was next because of, you know, criminal charges that could be pressed. Good call. Putting the chief's watch and clocks an hour ahead.
That's cute. So, and feels very Nancy Drew, but challenging.
Feels very Nancy Drew. Feels very like Michael Scott. You know, I'm like, doesn't seem criminal. Seems like a prank, you know, hijinks. So I support it. Start a fight in front of the police station. I'm not convinced that would have worked. Number four, threaten gang violence. Specifically, international Italian gang violence. Like, yes. They're going to just, like, start a paper trail showing that the Black Hand from Italy has come to, where are we in the United States right now? This
we
little
are
coastal
in
town.
Bayport, and they're going Bayport. To invoke the name of the mafia, essentially.
Exactly. And that'll probably do it. And last but not least, what we end up landing on, for better or worse, is we are going to plant a fake bomb at a nearby fruit stand.
No, and
it worked. Because it caused some consternation and drama, chiefly among the poor, innocent fruit stand owner who thinks his, like, livelihood is getting ready to be blown to smithereens. Yeah. Luckily, as I mentioned before, the chief and what's-his-face, Smuff, come and put it out with water, only to discover it's just, you know, like a ticking clock inside a box.
Listen, yes. Don't
everything you're thinking is correct.
Don't do any of these things. No. Don't do it.
But again, I will say this really it's shed so much light on, like, our dad. Doesn't
say,
it though?
Say more.
Well, and probably a lot of boys who grew up in the 50s who are reading these books, like, I think if you read these books, wouldn't you just kind of think, like, Oh, I mean, that seems like a reasonable thing to do. Joe and Frank Hardy planted a fank bomb. Why shouldn't I, you know?
Yeah.
Of course, yeah. Of course you would drive down the block in your car, like, throwing cherry bombs out the window.
Yes.
Like, these are your role models.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I know that, you know, when I was reading these in, like, first and second grade, I was like, that does seem totally normal that 16-year-olds have motorcycles and are going on high-speed chases. And
of course.
I was like, yeah, That's how it goes.
That's just what being a teenager is like.
Yeah. And then I was sorely disappointed because it was not.
Karen, if we may, should we discuss It Would Have Been Awesome If?
Yeah,
I want you to go first.
Mine is not realistic.
I don't know.
Something that I thought would have been awesome if it happened in this book, but I really did not enjoy how Mr. Robinson, the caretaker for the Applegate Mansion in Bayport. Why am I talking like this? I don't know. I just really hated how he was fired for this suspected theft for which there were no clues. There was no evidence. He clearly didn't do it. He was a stand-up character. Yeah. All I could think about in this moment was, you know who would not let this go down? Carson Drew. Mm-hmm. Amen. Thank you. Carson Drew would have busted in there and been like, I will be the pro bono attorney for this man.
Mm-hmm. And my daughter will be working to clear his name on the side.
Yes, they would have gotten to this solve much faster. And I, you know what? I was feeling vengeful for Mr. Robinson and Slim, who now can't go to college. He had to leave on a Thursday to become a grocer, like, which was not his dream. And I was like, I just want Carson to come in, be like, I will pro bono attorney this for you. I want him to sue the Applegates for wrongful termination and also the slander.
Absolutely.
They have wreaked on his name throughout the town of Bayport. And then I want Slim and his sisters to take that settlement money and go to college wherever they want.
I love that.
Ivy League.
I think that's a great It Would Be Awesome If.
Thank you.
It Would Be Awesome If is not predicated on realism.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's my imagination went wild and I was just like,
it's good.
Well, save the Robinsons. What is your, okay, you are always much better at this than me. What is your It Would Have Been Awesome If?
No, I'm not much better at it. I wanted you to go first because I'd read what your thought was and it's basically what I was going to say. So, like, it would have been awesome if, not that this was a crossover book, I'm not necessarily suggesting that, but it would have been awesome if we learn that we're in the same universe as the Clue Crew.
Love it.
You know, maybe not even like nearby location wise, like they don't have to live in the same town or live, you know, two towns apart or anything like that, but just it would be cool to know that they're in the same world, kind of about like the Carson thing. You know, I thought the same thing about Robinson needs a lawyer. But like there's one point when Frank and Joe are both like, we're never going to solve this thing. They're really bummed out and depressed. Like even their dad's kind of given up the case. And, you know, if Frank said something like, I bet that girl Nancy over in River Heights could have solved this already. Or, you know, we find out that Frank's football team is getting ready to play the Emerson College team or just something like that. You know, like that there's a little like we know they're in each other's orbit. So
love
the possibility for those planets to collide at some point would be fun.
I think Nancy would have some feedback for Fenton, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'd love to be a fly on the wall for that conversation.
Girl, same.
Okay, so we've been burying the lead unsuccessfully this whole time. But let's talk a little bit about key similarities and key differences between Miss Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys, or bros, as I have accidentally called them. I'm calling this section
like Hardy Bros.
The Nancy Drew Hardy Boys Venn diagram. Okay, I'll talk about similarities, and then do you want to talk about differences, and we shall discuss?
Sure.
Okay.
Yes. Yes, please, and thank you.
Key similarity: super famous rich dads.
Mm-hmm.
We've got Carson Drew, super famous rich attorney, internationally known. We've got Fenton Hardy, super famous rich dad, internationally known. Their names precede them, and their children benefit from this in that they get access to information and people and places that they would not mm-hmm. otherwise be allowed to access.
Absolutely.
Is that fair? Okay.
Yep.
We also, in both worlds, work with a posse.
True. Very good point.
We've got our Clue crew that we know and love after 56 some odd books, Nancy, Bess, and George. And in the Hardy Boys world, we have Frank and Joe, already a unit because they are brothers, but they have Chet, their mm-hmm. best friend. They have, I'm going to use the term girlfriend lightly here, but we've got Iola, we've got Callie. Yeah. And then, you know, although Chet and the girlfriends are kind of ancillary, they're not really helping to sleuth as much as Bess and George. They're definitely providing feedback. They're coming along on the journey.
Yeah.
They're bouncing ideas off. They're receiving the update phone calls, et cetera. So, like, you know, we've got a community around us.
Yes. Yes. They've got a crew, too.
I would say we have spontaneous father-sponsored travel that happens in these books. Mm-hmm. However, so y'all know exactly what I'm talking about with Nancy Drew. It's like, Nancy, I'm going to send you to Hawaii tomorrow to mm-hmm. solve this. I had an interesting adventure with this book in that I read the book first, and then I realized I may have been reading a slightly different edition than what you were listening to. So I read the book and listened to the audiobook out of fear for ruining this podcast. And I think the father-sponsored air travel for the Hardy Boys only happens in the book edition that I read. I think
okay, because I was like, I don't remember that in the audiobook. So.
Yeah, so I think the book that I read was the 1927 unedited one, and he actually brings them to New York for like 48 hours. They meet the Shakespearean actor with him, et cetera, and they're just
on the hunt for the Red Wigs.
Yep, and they're thrilled. They're like, we've never left Bayport before, so. In some versions of the Hardy world, we have spontaneous father-sponsored air travel.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Fair.
For the most part, both worlds have criminals who confess immediately upon capture. In the Hardy Boys world, it was stalled because Red Jackley was unconscious for a little bit. So we had to wait for him to revive. But, you know, when he did revive, he was like, yeah, here's the scoop.
Yeah. Wasn't for lack of willingness.
And then also, as you have noted, the criminals in these worlds typically have like a single identifiable trait. Mm-hmm. And it's like, he had red hair.
He had red hair.
He had a meandering gait. He had long
He tapped his leg
fingers.
With his fingers. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Any other similarities you would like to discuss?
We had two sets of two towers.
Twins.
We had double twins.
You're so right.
We had twin castle towers and twin water towers. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, like, vehicles are a super important thing in both of these books. Like, we're always talking about Nancy's convertibles and the boats and all this stuff, and then in these books, I mean, again, tons of different cars with very specific, like, you know, descriptions of the models and the motorcycles and stuff. So yeah, they're always cruising around doing stuff, which is fun.
You just made me realize something, which is a perfect transition, because I would like you to talk about key differences in the Venn diagram. I don't think we had a boating incident in this book.
Nope, no boating incidents.
All right, what else?
The series is young.
Yeah, what else we
never
got?
Never say never. So in Nancy world, when we meet Nancy, she is already amazing at sleuthing.
Yeah, yep. She's
like,
fully,
she comes to us fully formed.
Fully formed, that's what I was going to say.
Skills intact. You know, she definitely learns things. She grows. We all learn. We grow. We move forward. But like, she solves a case fully independently in the first book. The Hardy Boys are not yet fully formed.
Yeah, they're not so much like, I'm ready to crush this right out of the gate.
No, which not a criticism. It's just different. You know, they're still learning and. Like getting their sea legs under them,
which I really liked, honestly. It made this book much more, like, believable. Like, Nancy feels much more fantastical to me.
Yes.
And I have to suspend my disbelief a lot more with her. Like, how do you speak seven languages and have, like, skin diving skills and also know how to take a fingerprint off of a moving horse, you know? And the Hardy Boys are like, I don't know, I've never done this before, and I really appreciate that about them.
Take a fingerprint off a moving horse.
Did I just make you laugh? That makes this is the highlight of my fortnight when I make you
That was so funny.
When I make you laugh that hard, I feel like I've succeeded.
Oh god, Karen, that was good. Success is yours. Okay, so one thing is, I don't know if you picked up on this, but like in the Hardy Boys, they are talking about careers immediately. Oh. And a lot.
Okay.
Like, there is a lot of career talk, a lot about what are you going to be when you grow up, you know, and discussions about that. You know, their mom wants one of them to be a doctor and one of them to be a lawyer. Fenton, I don't think, weighs in on that. He just doesn't want them to be investigators. They want to be investigators. There's just, like, lots of, you know, future thinking about who we're going to be. And Nancy, I think that's been one of our criticisms, just maybe not phrased in this way, is that that just doesn't exist. You know, she's interested in this, I mean, almost as a hobby because she's interested in it and she's really good at it. And I think one of our beefs has been, why is she never thinking long term about what she could do with this professionally?
Yeah.
But that's just not a part of the Nancy Drew books. So, you know, I think in that way, it's definitely kind of shining a light on, you know, gender politics of, you know, the 50s when these books were really kind of formed. But I did just think that it struck me so clearly when that started to happen. I was like, oh, these guys get to have a career. Got it.
There's a little bit of weirdness, though, in that sleuthing is not enough for the Hardy Boys.
Mm-hmm.
I think it says it's their mom.
It is their mom.
Is very kind of dismissive of their sleuthery aspirations and is like, I want one of you to be a doctor and one of you to be a lawyer. And they're kind of traumatized by that. They're like, no. Like,
yeah, we want to do what dad does.
We don't do what dad does. But even their dad is like, yeah. Really? Okay, well, let's see if you can hack it. And I,
yeah,
baby angels, I'm just like, oh, celebrate your children. Let them explore.
Their mom, she doesn't, I think, say it about them, but talking about Fenton later, she really doesn't like to hear about his cases because it, like, upsets her and freaks her out.
Mm.
So I like, in my most generous heart, I choose to believe that it's because she doesn't like the people she loves potentially putting themselves in danger.
That's very fair.
Yeah.
If you were like, I'm going to hop a train with Red Jackley tomorrow and...
Yeah. Try to beat a confession out of him before he dies.
Like, I'd be like,
okay,
please absolutely don't do that.
Maybe my 16-year-old child, you should go to history class tomorrow instead.
Let's not. Yeah. How about you try out for the baseball team?
Right. Exactly. That sounds good. Yeah. Do you want another motorcycle? I'm sure we could come up with something. You know, please don't do the train thing, though. okay, so we talked about this already, but, like, there's a very different relationship with law enforcement from the Drewniverse. So very adversarial in the Hardy Boys books. No love lost. Really, the police are kind of, like, bumbling hillbilly idiots in this book. Like, it's very Mayberry, but in a not adorable way.
They're mean. They're very mean to the Hardys.
They're mean.
Yeah.
They're not good at their jobs. They're, like, obstacles, not helpers. You know, and obviously that's not the relationship Nancy has with, you know, pretty much any policeman she runs up against in the Drewniverse. They're like, bending over backwards to, like, give her information.
Yeah, and they want to hire her at every turn. They're like, can you please come help us? And she's like, I'm busy.
I will be right there. But I won't take any money for it. So that brings me to my next point beautifully. The motivation between the two is very different. So Nancy is motivated by solving the case.
Yes.
Like, she just really wants to, like, she wants to know who done it. And that's enough for her, as we see over the course of how many of our Nancy Drew books we've done so far. Like,
1 billion.
Yeah. She's not taking money. She's not taking payment. She turns down and donates rewards left, right, and center. So the Hardy Boys, while I won't say they are not at all motivated by, like, the intrinsic, like, nature of the solve, because I do think they want to clear Slim Robinson Sr.'s name, but they are highly motivated by the cash reward that's involved.
Yup.
And when they are given the reward of $1,000 cash, they take it and they don't donate it. They don't say, no, you know, your thanks is reward enough. They each take their $500 check and go to the bank. So that's different.
Yeah, Nancy is always very, she's very quick to refuse any sort of accolade.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
very humble.
While the Hardy Boys eventually become not excited to, but, like, motivated to save the Robinsons, the real mm-hmm. reason that they enter into this race is the $1,000. Like, let's be honest.
That's exactly right.
And then when the check is written, to your point, they're like, yes, please. Money, please.
Thank you so much. This was the oral agreement we came to.
I will take it.
Also, would you throw us a party? That would be cool, too.
Yes.
Definitely the Hardy Boys, just the writing is different. So it's much more like slice of life. We're meandering with them. It's, you know, there's a lot more like, where are we? Not Baywatch. Bayside?
Bayport.
Bayport. I'm having a mental block.
I like Bayside, like, though. Is that Saved by the Bell?
That's Saved by the Bell. Like, it's much like Bayport River. Real World Bayport would be a much more interesting show than River Heights Bayport. River. Oh my God.
I love you. Are you okay? Do I need to?
River Heights.
Struggle bus.
Oh my gosh, I'm on the struggle bus. You know what I'm saying. So. We're getting a lot more insight into their lives and their social scene and all of that. And the last thing I will say, and then I'm going to turn it over to you to see if I've missed anything, but the Hardy Boys, including Fenton as the third boy, like, they give up pretty easily.
They do. And that was really challenging for me as a reader. They're just like, we're out of clues. Yeah. But the trail
literally
has run dry. Yeah. Mystery can't be solved. We're done here.
Yeah. Sorry about you, Slim. Even as Slim is crying in front of them, like real, like the tears of a new grocer. And Fenton's like, I'm not a miracle worker, my man.
That's what, like, he said. Yes, I'm not a miracle worker. I'm just a detective. Like, I can't. Yeah. That was brutal. And we've never seen the Clue Crew.
Nancy would never
have that moment. Yeah, they Nancy were just like, it's done.
Nope. She has much more tenacity. So anyway, anything to add to this segment?
No, I don't think so. So is there anything that tonight, when you rest your sweet baby angel eyes, is going to keep you up about this book? Like, what open questions do you have?
So at the beginning of this book, Joe and Frank are riding motorcycles along the coast, and they have like a 2-chapter-long conversation while riding their motorcycles. And I suppose my question is that even possible? Like,
I no.
Good, great, thank you. That's I really just wanted you to tell me what I wanted to hear.
No, like no.
The noise I made when I realized that this whole conversation was happening on motorcycles, moving motors, I was like, oh my God.
Also, like, I'm assuming that in this situation they don't have helmets on, and
of course not.
Also, no. Like the coastal breeze, also exactly. The speed you're moving,
winding, curvy
the
roads.
Sound of the motorcycle. No.
Yeah.
No.
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 I mean, the last time I was in a car with someone on a road like that, I didn't want him to talk to me in the car. You know,
like,
I was like, why don't you just focus on the road?
Eyes on the road.
Yeah. Do you have any open questions that are going to keep you awake tonight?
Yeah, I just really, this is more just like a beef, I guess, but the Applegates, who are the people who have had their treasures stolen from their house, and the Hardy Boys are trying to find their treasure. They're just like rooting against the Hardy Boys. The Hardy Boys are just trying to help them. And
yeah.
They're like, there's no way you'll find the treasure in our house. You're wrong. You silly boys. And they laugh at them when they're unsuccessful. And I'm like, hot take, you feel like the bad guys to me.
Oh, they're the secondary bad guys for sure.
We're trying to find your wealth, of which we're going to receive basically nothing.
Yeah.
Buzz off.
And they are so quick to accuse their like loyal caretaker of the property. They're not very good people.
Yeah, I'm hugely not a fan of the Applegates.
I was really glad when Joe and Frank took their $1,000.
Absolutely.
And also like some chicken wings, you know.
Yes.
I was like, yeah, do that. So Karen, it's my favorite time. I've said that 3 times now, but this is the truth. This week we are rating the Hardy Boys the tower treasure out of a 12 possible decrepit water towers.
Oh, great. Well, here's my rating.
Great.
9 out of 12 decrepit water towers.
Oh, a very high rating.
I loved this book. I thought it was so charming, and I cannot wait to read more Hardy Boys books. I did remove 2 water towers for just admitting defeat too early.
I get it. Yeah.
I'm really accustomed to the perseverance that Nancy Drew has in the face of complications. And I was like, no, you can do it. Like, fight through it. I also removed 1 water tower for the parents of the Hardy Bros boys. I can't say it now. Not supporting their children's dreams. You know, just they're the future. Let them be sleuths if they want to sleuth.
I feel you.
What's your rating?
I'm rating it 10 out of 12 decrepit water towers.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
Yeah. -2 for terrorizing a hardworking immigrant who's just trying to make a living with a fake bomb.
Absolutely agreed.
-2 for basically like socially convicting Mr. Robinson with literally zero evidence. And like even when someone else confesses who's a known criminal, they're like, yeah, but I bet Robinson was still involved. So I hated all of that.
Agreed.
But +2 for general teenage hijinks. Like, I loved it. It felt much more like 18-year-old kids to me. They're definitely less effective than Nancy, but they act their ages. And I don't know. It was just like, it was a little haphazard, but that made it fun. So I loved it. Yeah.
Amen. So average rating, 9.5 out of 12 decrepit water towers.
Yeah, are you making these up now just so I have to try to find an illustration for them?
That is absolutely correct.
Good talk. Okay, yep. I suspected as much. Well,
best of luck with the Instagram.
So what are we reading next?
Something that you're so excited about, Kelly. Mm-hmm. We are going to read The Babysitter's Club. Is that a super special? Am I saying that right?
I think it's the first super mystery.
Babysitter's Club, super mystery, haunted house.
Mm-hmm.
And I just can't wait because I've really never read any of the Babysitter's Club books. So.
I'm so excited. I cannot wait. I hope they hold up to how I remember them in my brain.
I bet they will.
Well, folks, if you would be so kind, as always, please rate, review, subscribe, tell a friend, and don't forget to find us on Instagram at It's a Clue Podcast.
And if you feel like it, you can always become a Helen Corning friend on Patreon, which is a best friend of the show. We will give you a shout out at the beginning of the episode, and we have some short bonus content for new episodes about how we would solve the mysteries.
And Karen, most importantly, remember what we learned today in the Hardy Boys, the Tower Treasure.
What did we learn?
As per Fenton Hardy, there's many a slip twixt the cup and the lip. Or said more simply, there's no such thing as a sure thing.
Mm-hmm. And with that, Happy sleuthing!
It's a Clue is hosted by Kelly Biscopink and Karen Farmer. Our logo is designed by Courtney Kyle. You can find her on social media at I Am Courtney Kyle. The It's a Clue theme song was written and recorded by Danny W. You can find her on Facebook at Danny W. Music. Audio engineering is graciously done by our friend Mark Goodlow.